Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is MJ Network. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, who got me into this. And it's a beautiful day outside, and it's gorgeous. And we have a very wonderful author of the book, The Reckless Hair, David Putnam. Events happen in your life and come back at you when you least expect it. People that hold a special place in your heart disappear and then come out of nowhere, which change your entire perspective on situations as they unravel, and you begin to see things in a different light. Within this novel, Bruno Johnson, a detective in the Violent Crimes Unit, will look deep into his soul, understand his rage at times, and find himself in conflicting situations that involve people that he thought he could trust, thought he had his back, and learning the meaning of deception, betrayal, loyalty, and the true definition of the title of the book, The Reckless. That's the first paragraph of my review. Good morning, David. How are you? I'm so glad you're here.
Well, thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me on your radio.
I am excited. So tell us a little bit about Bruno Johnson, because I read the first book, too. And how did you create him?
Oh, it's kind of it's a little bit of a long story. I was writing for 25 years, and I was on my 38th book when I sold the fourth manuscript. So it took me a long time to figure out how to write, and I just switched to a thriller construction. But not only that, because I tried a bunch of different things, different mysteries to get published, I decided to go with something that was very emotional to me, and that was dealing with children in my job as a cop. So I put the children in, which can have a lot of emotion. But I also made Bruno Johnson an African American, which added another layer of conflict mm-hmm. for him in his job. I just decided to do it based on construction of the book. What would cause the most emotion to come out in the story? That's why I chose Bruno, and that's why I chose the topic. Bruno Johnson is an ex-cop, ex-con, who rescues children from toxic homes in South Central Los Angeles. He couldn't do it when he was a cop because there were too many rules and regulations. So now he goes outside the law to rescue the children. And that's the theme of the entire series. I wrote four books in current day. And in the fourth mm-hmm. book, I left Bruno pretty banged up and emotionally and physically hurt. So the publisher said that, asked me how was I going to bring Bruno back from that. So I decided mm-hmm. to start with prequels. So The Innocence is the first prequel, and The Reckless is the second prequel. I have two more planned. They just bought The Heartless, and I'm just finishing up The Ruthless.
Oh, I love those titles. I read The Innocent because they sent it to me, and I didn't know I was getting it. And then they sent me The Reckless, and that came at my door, and I go like, hold on a minute. Where'd this come? Ocean View is phenomenal, I have to tell you. They just send me everything.
Yeah.
I have some stuff that's not due out until next year sometime. I'll get to it eventually. But, yeah, this one hit me, and I go like, okay, wait a minute. This is coming out in February. I think Fran better read it. Because I guess they expect me to read everything that they send, plus everything else that I don't know about. Seriously. So in The Reckless, his sergeant and two others are asked to join the FBI to close cases because they don't want to deal with them that have been robbing banks for a very long time. How does he feel about that, and does he really want to do that?
Well, what makes it easier for me to write is I take a snapshot of my career and turned it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
So this book, The Reckless, is my time on the Violent Crimes Team where I was chasing bank robbers. So as it turns out, most of those cases that you read, 80% of this book actually happened. I put it just the way it happened. The Handsome Bandit thing, I changed the name of the Handsome Bandit because, to be honest, I couldn't remember the name of that crook that the FBI named him. The Bogart Bandit was a real case. I really enjoyed doing that work. It was, it was fun trying to hunt down fugitives. We were invited to the team, to create the team, to join the FBI, and I was happy to do it. That was your question, right?
Yeah, that's amazing. This is so interesting. We have no idea. And the fact that it's your real life, it makes it even better. That's what I realized, too. So when he goes home and he sees Ned, I really like Ned, at his doorstep with his daughter, why is she there? And what was his first reaction? Because he hasn't seen him in a very long time. Was he glad to see him?
Yeah, they were really good friends. They worked the street together, and they had a special bond. What happened, though, I tried to put in, like I said, real life adventures that I was involved in. In this book, I wanted to put in something that was very happened to me, where a good friend of mine was killed in a line of duty, which was Ned, as it turns out. So I wrote the book, and I wrote kind of a mystery structure instead of a thriller structure. I sent it in the publisher. They said, "We love the book, but we want you to cut the first 100 pages." So I actually cut out a huge number of stories of me getting to know Ned in real life and in the book. Mm. So I cut the first 100 pages, and I had to add to the back of the story, which it detracted from the story as a mystery, but it really enhanced it as a thriller. So I think the publisher was correct in having me cut it. But with the original 100 pages, I think it was more of a tearjerker than it is now.
Do you have to listen to them? Because, you know, I sent my new novel, if it ever gets published, to a real publisher. I'm waiting to hear from them. And they haven't turned it down yet in 6 weeks, so who knows? But do they tell you the title, or do they tell you what you have to cut out? What if you didn't want to cut it out? They wouldn't publish the book?
You know, I said I tried for 25 years to get published. I had four agents. I quit counting at 156 rejections. So when they picked up the disposables, I was just so pleased. And they do a good job. They put a great book together. I'm very happy with working with them. I mean, that Reckless and the Innocence, those covers, the books are just well done, I think. So it's they're buying the book. You know, that once they buy it, it's theirs. So if I said no to it, would another publisher pick it up? I doubt it, because it's a series already in progress. That rarely happens unless you're a real big name. So I had a choice of saying, I could have pushed back and seen what they said, but I decided to go with them because, you know, they've been good to me.
I don't blame you. I don't know if this guy's going to take it, but there were two more people that said they would, so that makes me feel better. You never know.
Oh, very nice. Congratulations. It's tough. It's a tough industry.
Yeah, well, they're small print, you know, small press.
Yeah.
And I don't write like you do, which is fantastic. I write from the point of view of a dead person behind the gravestone that got there because they deserve to be dead. And what's wrong? Well, I'm just different. So when he goes to this meeting with the FBI, reintroduce another character, Chelsea. And how does he feel when she walks into the room, and how does he feel about her having her there? I'm leaving out the second part of the question.
Chelsea is a carryover character from The Innocents. I created her for The Innocents, and Bruno had a pretty fiery romance with her in The Innocents.
Mm-hmm.
And I left that open-ended. She got transferred to North Dakota or South Dakota, one of the Dakotas, at the end of The Innocents. And you always try to throw up roadblocks or shockers to the character so you keep things moving. And I thought bringing her back would really put a wrench in Bruno's life at the time of that showing up at the FBI office. That's why I did it.
That is not very nice. My poor guy. He's gone through so much. Yes, and his daughter's a trip and a half, too. She reminds me of some of my nieces. Yeah, that a little. So when they read the file in the first case, you know, it's really amazing that they asked for their help, but they really asked for their help because they didn't want him to do it. They want him to fail. That's so wrong. So they were failed. So what happens when they do the first case? They cut egg on their face?
I wrote that as I remembered it, the conversation in the office, the secretary coming in and saying, as a bank robbery, and the smart-ass comment that I made to the FBI about catching him after lunch. All that actually really happened as I wrote it. And we got lucky and caught him after lunch. It was kind of a surreal kind of thing. The FBI at the time we were doing this, Southern California was having 2,400 bank robberies a year. It was just an epidemic. They were putting up what they called burglar bandit barriers in the banks, and they were the thick plexiglass, bulletproof plexiglass. Some of the banks still have them because they couldn't stop this epidemic. So, and this is what I was told, that the Berlin Wall came down and they had all these counterintelligence FBI agents with nothing to do. So they shifted them over to street crime, and they created these violent crime teams all across the U.S. And because of the bank robbery problem in Southern California, they targeted us for bank robberies. And it wasn't the FBI had a huge number of agents working at this office that I was in, but there were so many, they were just inundated. So when we walked in, they just handed us a pile of, here, take these and see what you can do, kind of thing. And it wasn't necessarily that they couldn't solve them. Maybe they could if they put the time into them, I don't know. But there was just a huge number. And so we just picked, you know, the ones we wanted and went after them.
That's amazing. And it's amazing that the FBI admitted that they wouldn't be able to do it, but then they didn't really want anybody to figure it out. So it makes you feel good to know that you can do that. Yeah, I've got one up on them, that's for sure. So tell us about the Dark Man and how that brought memories back to Bruno. I don't like that character.
The Dark Man was better sketched out in the 100 pages that I had to cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was an incident with that Bruno and Ned went to where the Dark Man was first introduced. But as I said, I take something from my career and infuse it within the storyline. And when I was working on this violent crimes team, I looked and acted and talked and walked too much like a cop. So I wear a khaki work shirt with a truck driver patch that said Grace Trucking, and a name patch over my other breast that said Carl. And I had 6 or 8 of these shirts, and I wore them all the time. In fact, I wore them so often my captain quit calling me by my regular name and kept calling me Carl. So a lot of people that just came into the department started calling me Carl. They thought my name was Carl for the longest time. So I was on a surveillance of this one group of bank robbers, and we got on them because they had passed some dye pack money in Las Vegas. They were gambling money that was dyed red. So it came from a bank robbery. So the intelligence came to us. We picked up the crew, and we were following them around, seeing what they're going to do. And one night, I was up. I had the lead on the surveillance of this one bank robber, and he went into a bar in the city of Riverside. So I went in and sat at the bar, dressed like a truck driver, and had a beer with this bank robber. I mean, sat right next to him, talked to him.
Oh, God.
He had no idea that I was a cop. And 3 days later, we caught him coming out of the bank with a bag of money in his hand and a gun in the other. And he still didn't recognize me, even though I was still wearing my truck driver shirt. So I thought I'd put him in as a character in as Dark Man in the book.
That is scary. Did you ever do a case like this or anything and worry, like, am I going to come out of this? Am I afraid? Am I going to be okay? Doesn't it bother you at all? Did it ever bother you at all?
You know, a lot of people ask me that question, but maybe I was just ignorant to the fact. When I did it because I enjoyed it. It was the action that I that I craved. I just loved chasing the bad guys, and I did two tours in the SWAT team, and going into a house after an armed suspect, there's nothing like that kind of high, that kind of rush.
Maybe you should write for Criminal Minds, and maybe some of the kids, the stories would be much better. Seriously. Yeah, I know. I could feel the tension, and I could feel the action as I was reading the book and getting nervous and saying, "Is Bruno going to come out alive of this one? Is anybody going to come out alive?" I was like, "Oh my God!" So, well, Chelsea worried me. What is with her, and who is Turner? Just briefly.
Well, Turner. See, the readers read for, like I said, for emotion, and conflict is emotion. So Turner was Chelsea's current love interest, and so that was causing Bruno a little bit of jealousy and emotion. So I threw Turner in there, and he's also an antagonist within the FBI that throws roadblocks up for Bruno during his investigations.
There's always somebody that does things like that, but that's okay, people, because, Bruno's got the upper hand somehow. I don't know. So, tell us more about who is Hannah and what is her relationship to Ned?
Hannah was Ned's wife, and like I said, in 100 pages that I cut, I shouldn't be talking too much about that. There was, and I think I did it in a flashback, but Ned is kind of a wild character. He's hard to get a handle on. And he has this drop-dead gorgeous blonde wife, and she's kind of tired of Ned's nefarious activities. And so there's some friction in the relationship. And the story opens with Ned having custody of his daughter. I got it mixed up. Hannah is the wife, right? Yeah, is Ned's wife, isn't she?
We're not going to say too much about her now. The character that I really liked is his father. The character I really liked is Bruno's father.
Yeah, everybody says that, and it's interesting because he's more of a foil for Bruno. He's the foundation that Bruno came from. So he has high moral standards that Bruno has to follow. And sometimes he can't follow because he has to go around certain things to get things done. So he's very conflicted over that. But his father is like an icon to him. And in the book I'm writing right now, the fourth prequel, it's 50% of the book is about his dad.
And when is that coming out so I know when they're sending it to me?
Okay. There's a book, three of the prequels, The Heartless, is going to come out probably first week of February next year. The one I'm finishing now, and I think it's probably going to be my best book to date, is going to come out February of 2021 if they pick it up. But I don't know why they wouldn't, knock on wood. But, you never know.
Well, I guess when it comes out in February 2020, they'll do what they did last year and send it to me in August of 2019. That's when they sent me the other one. I knew that.
Okay.
So, everybody has. Did you have informants when you were? Because he's got Angie and Ollie. So, what is the purpose of reaching out to these people?
Ollie was a real informant that I actually used. She was a character. I took her. I described her just the way she was, the way she looked, the way she talked, and I come on that Ollie kind of I didn't go looking for, well, I did in a way. I was looking for an informant, but I was chasing a federal fugitive. The FBI wanted him for 2 years for murder and drug trafficking, and they couldn't catch him. So I went after ancillary characters within this guy's life. So I pulled the reports and booking, and I find out who he ran with. And so I went after a woman that this guy named Bunky. Bunky was the one wanted. I went after his cohorts, and Ollie happened to be one of his cohorts. So I set up on a house and happened to be in Ontario. Ollie came walking out, and she got in a car. and it was a BMW 700 series, and we were in a Cougar, and I recognized her from her photo and description, and so I rerun the plate on the BMW, and it was stolen. So I needed a hammer on her so she would flip and give me Bunky. So the stolen car was perfect. I mean, she comes out of the apartment, gets into the stolen Beamer. All I got to do is pull her over and tell her she's going to jail for the car, and hopefully she'll flip and give me Bunky. So we're in a plane car, a Cougar, my partner and I, and I'm calling for Ontario Police Department to pull the car over, and she's moving. She's unaware that we're behind her, but every time she's moving so fast, Ontario can't get up to us. They can't catch up to us. So she finally sees that we're on her, and she just takes off. And the car can out maneuver us very easily in handling and in power. But she couldn't drive it. If she knew how to drive, she would have lost us because she was taking the corners all wrong. But we were really going too fast on the public streets. And it was getting hazardous. So we made this one corner, and I told my partner, get up next to her. And I got up next to her, and I hung up my window, and I stuck a gun right in her face while we're driving down.
Oh, my God.
And I yelled I was going to shoot, and she pulled over. And then I did flip her, and she gave us this guy. She set up a meet with him, and we took him down in L.A., and it was a great case, and we went to court. And I got the stolen car squashed, her case suppressed, and she kind of caught what I call the 007 syndrome. She liked working with me so much that I would call her and I'd say I need this guy, and she would go looking for him. And so she was like a mole in South Central Los Angeles. And I was working for the FBI, and they had all kinds of money, so I started paying her. I would pay her several thousand dollars for a federal fugitive. And it was working out pretty well.
She wasn't afraid? She wasn't afraid that somebody was going to see her or do something to hurt her?
She should have been. But, you know, it's the rush. It's the thrill of the chase. And she caught that same thing, and she just really had a good time with it. She never got hurt, not unlike in the book, but she just kind of eventually faded off because I got promoted, and that was my biggest mistake, leaving detective where I had autonomy and went to sergeant where I had to supervise people like me.
Oh, you probably did a good job. I think you know, my 36 years of teaching in a tough school in the Bronx were just fine, too.
Yeah, I'll bet. That's something that's
I loved every minute. I loved every minute of it. I must have done a good job because my students are on Facebook and they keep reminding me of what a great job I did and how tough I was, but they're all doing very well. So it makes me proud.
Well, that's nice.
But,
you know, I went to a library talk. I do a lot of talks. And this woman who put it on, she was a teacher. She taught at a high school. And she read Bruno, and she liked Bruno so much that she emailed me and asked if I would send her some books. So I sent her three sets of the first three Bruno books.
Oh,
and
nice.
Over a hundred of her students read the books, and they did reviews and sent them to me. And I thought, I didn't think of them as high school books, but I guess they really are. And so then she asked me to come and talk at the high school. So 2 weeks ago, I went to the high school, and I talked. I did 6 one-hour consecutive talks at the high school for the whole class.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so it was very rewarding for me to talk to those students, and the questions that they asked was very intelligent and moving.
You know, it's funny that you should say that they did book reviews. In my last magazine, which is MJ Magazine that just came out 3 weeks ago, I had book reviews by students ages 5 to 17, and it was from a specific site, and I've actually read the books. The book reviews were excellent, otherwise I wouldn't have published them, besides my brilliance over there. But that is great that kids are going to read the book and learn how to write a book review. That, you know, teachers don't do enough to teach them about research and how to write, and that was my specialty as a reading and writing specialist and being the dean. So, tell us about Sergeant Kaufman and why Bruno feels he needs to retire. Oh, poor man.
Again, I took him from an actual character in my life.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very big influence. I loved the guy. He was like right out of Central Casting, and he, you know, his background, everything. I kind of copied from the real character. But he had stayed too long in it. He stayed too long in a job, and society just kind of overran him. He was too antiquated, and in the book, I just kind of in real life it was just mildly, but in the book I kind of over accentuated that for the conflict.
Well, I feel bad for him, but that's okay. The one thing about Bruno is he's just like me. He's blunt and to the point. Sometimes you gotta get in trouble. So what kind of, he gets in trouble. So what other agents were involved, and how does he basically, except for Ned, how does he work with other people? Because if he's anything like me, he takes charge. Seriously.
Yeah. He's kind of a special breed of cat, because he and Robbie Wicks, his supervisor in the four prequels, they chase the worst of the worst. And in order to do that, they have to kind of set themselves aside from the norms of society and do things that probably wouldn't be accepted normally in order to get the job done, to catch these murder suspects. So, yeah, Bruno, he continues to evolve in the prequels, where he ends up in the disposables at the first current day book. And that's what I did. I gave Bruno a huge background when I opened Disposables, the first book in that series, the first book the publisher purchased from me. And the prequels are all those, all that background that I gave him when the Disposables opened. I'm just showing what happened instead of telling the backstory in the prequels.
I think the hardest part for Bruno in this novel was that he was not allowed, he wanted to get the kids, but he couldn't harm them or hurt them. So why is the case involving Cat more, why is that more dangerous than anything? Because you have to be careful. You don't want to sue children, although these kids were dangerous than themselves.
Right, and the kids were just misguided. This was big,
yeah,
for a real,
I know,
case.
Sad.
And they were recruited off of basketball courts and told that they won't go to prison for robbing a bank because they're under 18, and they were given guns and a stolen car and told how to rob the bank while the facilitator watched. We actually took down several of these juvenile crews, and it was kind of tough because if they panicked and started shooting, then how could you justify shooting, you know, a juvenile?
Mm.
So in some cases, we just blocked the car. We saw that we planned it out very carefully, and we had enough vehicles, and we just zoomed in and actually blocked the car so they could take off and have a pursuit, and then we called them out.
Oh, wow. This is exciting, because I've interviewed FBI people and other people, but this is really, really exciting to know this is really true life, which I did look up and see that it was, actually. That's just me. So when Ollie asks him, she asks him a big favor. How come she asked him that favor? I'm changing the question. I'm not trying not to say too much.
Yeah. Ollie trusts Bruno, and she came to him with a very difficult question. Her nephew had crossed the line, and she was worried that he was going to get hurt. And she asked Bruno to try to rescue him. And because she trusted Bruno to do it, it made another layer of conflict, because Bruno would have to try to help him without getting him hurt as well.
As an educator for a million years, this next part really got to me, because if a child came up to me and said that they had somebody that physically or sexually abused them, I reported it in 10 seconds. And the scary part is, I was never wrong. And I said, if I'm wrong, I'll apologize, but I was never wrong. So this part with that really upset me. How does Ned deal with something like that? I mean, Beth is a little kid, and how do you deal with, as a police officer, with somebody that commits child abuse and hurts a little kid or any child without just cause, just because they feel like it, they get angry, or they don't want, or the child cried or something like that?
You're kind of breaking up, and it's not my connection. Like I said, that is one of the most difficult cases to handle, and I didn't like, that was one of the only cases that I really didn't like to handle because of the emotion and the pain that's involved. It's hard to handle. It's hard to handle the adults that would do something like that without getting very angry at them. So, and there are experts within the department that handle specific cases like this, but. You know, as a first responder, I would get these investigations, and it would just be heart-wrenching. So I try not to, in my Bruno books, I try to put that off stage because it is off-putting and people don't want to read that kind of stuff. So I just kind of infer that it happened. In this one, I actually took the veil off a little bit more and showed it more this time, but just very little. But they are very tough cases to investigate.
Yeah, I know. I had a father come in for open school night one day, and I had a little girl came in one day, and she said, "You see the marks on my arm? My father took a switch to burn my arm." I said, "Okay," and I reported it. And then he came to open school night. He said, "I'll do it again." I said, "I think the police officer behind you is going to stop you." I couldn't believe that I had the guts to do this. And I made sure I was scared because, you know, they get out very quickly. I mean, they just pay whatever the bail and they get out. And I had told the mother, I said, "You better do something." And then about 2 years ago on Facebook, this girl said to me, "You saved my life. I'm fine. I'm a parent." And he's gone. And I was like, you know, you worry. But that's just
very nice. That's very nice.
Well, the neighborhood I taught him was not exactly the safest in the world, but it never bothered me.
I'll bet.
And I'm 5 feet tall and 107 pounds of nothing. So how do they try to take down Cad or the Darkman? How do you take down somebody like that?
Well, the problem with that is it's, and I go over it in the book, it's conspiracy because he doesn't actually have the gun in his hand or any of the evidence. You got to catch him with the evidence. To link him to the bank robbery. So it was a pretty slick operation that he had going. So, I don't want to give away what happens in the book, but in real life, it was the same situation. How do you take down somebody who's on the peripheral without conversation? If we had conversation that, you know, him telling the kids what to do and how to do it, and you have the overt act with him giving them guns, that kind of thing, and give them the stolen car, you can take them down. But without conversation and statements, the conspiracy is very difficult to get in court. So he was tough to take down.
I can imagine. I'm surprised that anybody could take somebody like that down because they're pretty smart, clever, I know. So Chelsea, tell me a little bit more about her and her relationship with Bruno a little bit. I don't know.
Chelsea starts off as a sterling character with sterling morals, but life kind of grinds her down. And she, as Bruno evolves a certain way, Chelsea evolves in a different way. And Bruno's unaware of it, what's happening. But Chelsea's just trying to take care of herself, and she thinks that that life is no longer what it used to be for her. And I did that again because of conflict and emotion.
You did, and I know, and I won't say any more about that. Now, the person that I wasn't really crazy about was Wicks. How come he wasn't nice to my Bruno? Seriously, I didn't like him at all.
Wicks is, because of what happens later on in the disposables, I had to make Wicks a complex character where Bruno just loves and respects this guy and honors him, and Wicks treats him poorly. And the reader sees it, and Bruno and other people say something to Bruno. Bruno says, you just don't understand him. Because Bruno has been through some harrowing things with Wicks. some really violent confrontations, some shootouts where they became very close. And Bruno thinks that he knows Wicks, that at his core, they're the best friends you could be. But the reader's saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this. And I wanted the reader to say, is Bruno right or am I right? And so I try to put that complexity in the Wicks character.
You did, and I didn't like him at all. I wanted to smack him in the head a couple of times.
Yeah.
Seriously, I mean, he got me upset. But this, while the pieces fit together, seriously speaking, do people get bosses or commanding officers or people like Wicks? I mean, that don't appreciate the fact that somebody like Bruno would be on the force in real life?
The cop job is like anything else. When you get humans involved, you're going to have all kinds of different types of people, and some are better than others. As it happens in the law enforcement, for example, to be a cop in Southern California, I don't know if the numbers, I've been out for a few years now, but it used to take 1,200 applicants to get one cop through the academy, because the six tests that you have to take are so rigorous, and it just knocks a lot of people out of the running. So they try to put the best people in that they can. And that's what happened in LAPD, the Rampart incident. I think it was called the Warren or the Christopher Report. LAPD had to hire 1,000 new officers. And if you have 1,200 applicants for each position, 1,000 positions, you have a whole lot of folks that you have to reach out to. So they couldn't hire enough people fast enough to fill the positions, so they lowered their standards. They lowered the standards of those six tests, and that's what happened with they hired some undesirables, and they actually had to go back and retest those people that they hired and weed them out. It was a big mistake. So Wicks is a hunter. He's in for the thrill. He really doesn't care that much about the job, other than that it gives him a license to chase these violent criminals. And he will do anything and step on anybody to get the job, to have that thrill. Not to get the job done, but to have the thrill of the chase. And just now, in the fourth book, he's starting to recognize that.
Well, before I forget, I don't want to forget, Thursday, I'm doing a special with playwright, author, television actor Herbie Pallotta. We're doing a memorial in memory of Mary Tyler Moore. The Mary Tyler Moore story. That's Thursday at 11. On Tuesday, you know, this I get a lot of books I don't know I'm getting. Seriously. Barry Eisler, The Killer Collective. That was a surprise. And on Thursday, I'm ecstatic, besides having this interview, Philip Margolin, The Perfect Alibi. On the 11th, somebody you probably know, Brian Freeman, Crooked Street. On the 14th, the author of Forgotten Hours, and from what I understand, a lot of people are reading it. Then on the 19th, Andrea Kane, she'll be dead in a week. And the 21st, a funny story, Matthew Lee Goldberg, Desire Card. And what happened, David, was on Facebook he put something on my friend Vincent Dandry's wall, and I said, watch out, I'm reading your book, The Killer Thriller. It wasn't him. It was a different David, Matthew Goldberg. But Lee Goldberg is coming on my show on the 28th anyway with Killer Thriller, because my mistake proved out to be smart. What can I say? You just never know what I was going to do. And Killer Thriller is hilarious. If you've never read, I've never read Lee Goldberg, but his character, the guy has murders or whatever happens, and it really happens in real life. It really just happens. Everything he writes in his novels, in the book, happens to his character. They just relive everything. It's scary. And on the 28th, I am so excited, Mark Greeney, Mission Critical. He's going to end the month. That is like, whoa. I can't believe
that. That's a very nice lineup. Very nice lineup.
Yeah.
In fact, I read a lot of those books. In fact, Lee Goldberg, he emails me all the time for information on technical information on cop stuff. In fact,
really?
When you have him on the show, ask him about me. Ask about me.
I will, and I'm going to add it to my list of questions, because I almost fell off my chair when he said it went through the show. It's like, oh, my God. I think other than, I mean, interviewing you and my very first author I ever interviewed ever, and I asked her myself, was Tess Gerritsen. She's like the greatest person in the universe. But last week I was totally in awe when I interviewed Douglas Pressman for Verses of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh, my God. To think little me. But I
that's very nice.
That's why I asked you to come on the show too. I go, wait a minute, how am I going to get David Putnam to do this? Because basically, the publicist at Ocean View, I do this myself, and then I remind them, guess what? You should really listen. So, when the pieces all fit together, and Bruno realizes everyone is not where they seem, how does he deal with all these betrayals without saying what they are? Because that's hard.
Well, the biggest conflict at the end is Bruno has always been followed his morals. He has certain standards that he follows, and he had to make a decision to step aside the black and white law to handle this situation, and that was the biggest conflict in the theme of the book. And so you probably have to read the book to find out what he does, but he makes the choice, and right, wrong, I think he did a good job personally.
Well, he must have conflicts too, just to decide what's right, what's wrong, what is going to happen, whatever. That's hard. And my other question is interesting, because you have to go to court after you get all the evidence. Do you ever find that the judges give you a hard time or gave you a hard time?
Well, there again, it's what happens in real life and what is in movies or in novels.
Mm-hmm.
When I was chasing murder suspects, in real life, homicide mm-hmm. detectives are highly trained, and they put a lot of time and money into training them. And that's why they stay in homicide a long time, because they're very valued because of their expertise. And the longer you're in, the more your expertise you have in court. So in real life, they put the case together. They investigate it. They get a warrant, and then they hand it off to somebody to chase the guy down. So that's what I did. I was on a dog team. I would chase the homicide suspects. So the case is already made. I don't have to collect the evidence. I don't have to go to court.
Mm-hmm.
All I do is chase
That's
the guy
great.
Down and put him in jail. So, no, most of the time, in most homicide cases, I never went to court, never testified. I never had to collect evidence. And the law allows me to use whatever ruse or subterfuge to catch him. So I used to play all kinds of tricks to get people in custody.
That sounds so cool, but so dangerous. Do you miss doing that?
Oh yeah, I still have dreams about it. That was the best job. I love going to work. It was a great job.
Yeah, but just like Bruno or Ned or anybody, doesn't it affect? I did date a few police officers, and I found that sometimes they were kind of distant, kind of cold, kind of whatever. My next door neighbor was a police officer. I was so glad he was there. Seriously, doesn't it affect your family? Isn't it kind of hard sometimes?
Again, everybody has different personalities. You know, you got the human element.
Yeah.
So there's a variety of different, it had to affect me in some way, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have any residual effects. My wife says
I got an email. Your wife, Mary, I'll ask Mary. She emailed me the other day to make sure that I knew that you were doing the show. Thank goodness she did that.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, I know because my next door neighbor had three children, and actually, it was nice having a police officer next door to me. Felt safer.
Yeah.
At the end of this
yeah.
novel, it leaves us wondering why he did what he did at the end. I don't want to say what he did. At the end of the novel, Bruno does something that I was surprised he did. Is that going to come back at him in the next one?
It changes Bruno. It makes him realize that he can't. The world isn't as he wants it to be. It can't be. In order for him to make things work, he has to change his way of thinking. And so, yes, it does change him quite a bit in the next couple of books.
Well, I won't tell anybody what the ending was, but it brought me into tissues, let me tell you. I was surprised and thought, oh, my God. Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't only affect, you know, the person. It affects other people, too, as a matter of fact. So,
right.
Seriously. There was one other person I didn't bring out, and that was Angie. She was another informant. Was she a real person, too?
Yes. Yeah, most all the characters are not throwaway characters. There's somebody that I ran into in order for me to visualize them and write about them, to hear their voice, the way they move. I pick somebody from my past, and I just plug them in to that. So, yes.
How did you create Hannah's boyfriend?
That guy is an amalgamation of a couple of guys that I work with. Mm-hmm. Neither one of these two guys I took him from were as bad as he was, but combined he was very bad. So I took a background from one guy, and I took, you know, the way another guy talked and that kind of thing, and made him. He's a extraneous antagonist that Puno has to deal with. There's three plot lines in that book, and he's in one of the plot lines.
Yeah, one of the questions that's not in the whatever, my question, how do you create a bad guy, besides, you know, from real life, whatever? You make the personality of the person based on the real life experience? Because if somebody was listening, and there are people listening, I know there are people listening, how do you create that villain, that bad guy? I make him like you did. I could feel I was getting angry at this person. Like I want you to just pop his head off. I wanted Bruno to pop his head off. So how do you create that character to make people really hate him and wonder is the protagonist going to get him?
It's in writing fiction, the hero has to have flaws. Now, if he doesn't have any flaws, then he turns into a caricature. Same thing with an antagonist. A bad guy, he can't be so evil. Otherwise, he turns into a caricature. So in order to give a bad guy flaws, you have to make him human. You got to give him some humanity. So it's easy to make him bad. What's the difficult part is to give him just a touch of humanity so he's not a caricature. And in book two, I don't know if you've read book two, The Replacements, I wrote about the most evil person that I had ever dealt with. And this guy was a sociopath, psychopath. He was very, very bad, committed multiple murders. And I put him in the book, I gave him some humanity, and Marie, Bruno's wife, kind of befriends him and tames him. And I still didn't like him because in real life, this guy was just heinous. So I killed him off in book three, in the squandered, the first squandered. I sent it to the publisher, and the publisher said, oh, we like Carl Drago. You can't kill him off. So because I gave him too much humanity. See, that's a fine line that you walk. So I actually made the character so complex by doing that, by trying not to make him a caricature. I went the other way. So to keep Carl Drago, and I'm carrying him through all my books now because of what I did in that second book. And believe it or not, the second book is the one that the women like the most. It's kind of odd that this epitome of evil, and this is the one that I get the most questions about, The Replacements.
I don't think they sent me that one. I think the first one they sent me were The Innocents, and then they sent me this one.
Well, email me your address, and I will send you the books that you don't have.
Oh, good, because it'll give me more books to read. That's good. I you know, it's just speaking of real-life criminals, I just read by Ron Francell, Gerald and Alice, and it's a true story that they took them 39 years to get them to admit that they killed four people. And I'm reading this and I'm going like, oh, it's scary. The author actually interviewed this guy, and they still haven't found the three bodies of his ex-wife and his two adopted sons. He won't tell them where they are. And that
it's
is
called
like
Gerald and Al. It's called Gerald and Alice. Okay.
Yeah,
I'll look it up.
Gerald and Alice by Ron Francell. Yeah, and he said that it's a true story, and the pictures of them are in there. And it took till Alice was 70, she must be 79 now, and he's about 74, 75, and he's in jail, and he won't tell. I'm interviewing him because I have to hurt no more. This is like really got to me. And, yeah, it's my curiosity. I'm terrible. And I said, gee, you know, this is really a true story, and the pictures, he shows the pictures of when they were younger, and they show the poor kids. And what he did was Alice said to him, if Virginia is getting in my way and she wants money for support to whatever, and if you don't kill her, I'm going to leave you. So he just killed him. Didn't even join him. Didn't care. Oh. Nothing. Scary.
Huh.
Well, really scary.
Yeah.
So the ending of this book, I'm not going to say what happened. How will Bruno deal with this in the coming novels? And is he ever going to get promoted? Because he really needs to get promoted, because I said so. Seriously.
Well, his life continues to spiral downward until he starts to come back up in the disposables. So he has two more novels mm-hmm. where I just pile on the conflict and the problems and the angst.
Oh,
and,
cool.
So, yeah, his life just continues to get worse, and his dad continues to support him more and more in the next two books. The next book, The Heartless, is taken from a real-life escape from our jail where some crooks went in a conspiracy, a very intricate and planned-out conspiracy, and they drilled out the windows, one window of visiting with electric drills, and six murder
Ooh.
Suspects got out at once. Yeah, so that's what the next book is all about that. And it's kind of just a placeholder because I needed to advance Olivia, Bruno's daughter, in time.
Oh, I like
so
her.
She's
sweet.
Older, and she's sweeter and nicer even in the next book, The Heartless. But it all comes to a big conclusion in the book I'm writing right now, The Ruthless. Everything I wrote in all the books are now coming to a head in this one book.
I'm going to have to read that. You know, I have a pile on my chair, people. If I took a picture, you'd be shocked. It's like 25 books on my chair that I have to read. And I just finished. For those of you that didn't pre-order Sunshine State by D.P. Lyle, it's really good and it's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious.
Oh, good.
And there is a serial killer who killed seven people, but he claims he didn't kill two of them, and he hires Jake Longley and his uncle's firm in order to prove that he's innocent of two murders. That's all I'm saying.
Huh.
And they actually go to Pine Key. It's a real place. And I was like, okay. So before we end, Beth and Hannah, will they remain in Olivia's life? Are you going to bring them back at all, or are they done by an end of it?
In the next two books, they are not going to be in Bruno's life, but in book 9 of the current day series, I'm going to bring them back. I'm going to bring back a whole lot of characters in book 9. But no, the next two books, I don't. What?
That's good. I'm excited. So, where can everybody learn more about you and your work? And if you're going to send me more books, you have to autograph them so I can prove to everybody that you signed them.
Okay.
That's my only prerequisite.
You can get me on my website, davidputnambooks.com. And if anybody ever has any questions, law enforcement questions or book questions or writing questions, I'm happy to answer them. And you can get me through that website.
I might actually ask that question because my new book, it's called Silent Voices. Like I said, the first two stories are real. One is about my grandmother that was in a Polish sterilization camp and why she got there, and she's telling her story. And the other one is about my other grandmother that was sent to America and sold to slavery by her parents to her family.
Holy
and then the rest of them.
Well, that is a good story.
Yeah, I just hope it's really good. And then one of the New York Times authors, I won't say which one, read it and gave me some feedback as to how to make it better, and I appreciated it because he said I should flesh out the characters and do some backstory. One is about a teacher that was horrible, and the other three are just I made up. But there's a book called Golden State, and by Ben Winters. I read it, and I love it because if you don't tell the truth, you're in big trouble. So my last story is, if you tell a lie, you're better off. And that was my... you never know what's going to strike me as being whatever. What can I say? But
yeah,
thank you
exactly.
So very much. And I'm doing a panel show, everybody, on April 3rd, Charles Salzberg, Bruce Coffin, a new author. I just read his book called Funk It, and that's Jerry Farrell and Larry Thompson. And we're going to talk about setting, but not in a typical way. In Fran's way of doing setting. I just did a show with like 6 people. That was an experience on dialogue. And I'm going to think about doing another one in June, and I may bother you to do that because people need to understand. I read a book once with a crime scene, and I emailed the person who I was reviewing it for, and I said, I'm not reviewing the book because the crime scene made no sense. Why would the chief of police say he couldn't do something and ask this retired guy and his wife to dig out the bones from a grave? It's just,
yeah.
I mean, I've read over 9,000 books, my husband said. He counted my reviews on the other thing, and I'm saying, like, there is no way that would ever happen in real life. At least I hope not. So
that's right.
I want to thank you so much for today. This has been fun.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to send
you
the link to the show. Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you. Bye.